Monday edition of the Dunked on Basketball podcast. The special guest I alluded to on yesterday's show is here, someone I've been looking forward to having on for a long time since she did an awesome job on the New Orleans-Miami Christmas Day game. WNBA champion, Olympic gold medalist, and one of my favorite ESPN analysts, Carol Lawson. How are you?
I'm good, Nate. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad we got a chance to work this out. I had a little college basketball hiatus there for the month of March, and so now I've had a few weeks to get locked back into the NBA, and I've been enjoying the playoffs, that's for sure.
Yeah, awesome. So you've been doing NBA Tonight basically for the last week or so. If you've been in the studio watching all the games and then analyzing them. I wanted to start with the Charlotte-Miami series, and you did a piece on the Saturday Night Show on Frank Kaminsky and how he was able to be so effective in that game against Miami, especially when he started off kind of poorly. Seemed like sort of a non-traditional move to go with him, a seven-footer guarding Luol Deng when the Heat were a little smaller. How is he able to be so good in that game?
Well, yeah, it was a little bit surprising, I think, for Steve Clifford to go with that. But they need guys that can score, and we know that Kemba can, we know that Al Jefferson can, but with Batum out, you have to find a way to create offense in other areas. And Frank is pretty good in terms of one on one and being able to create his own shot, particularly when he has the length advantage over guys. And so he had a little nice stretch there in the third quarter where Miami continued to be small, and he got some favorable matchups and had it going there a little bit. So, you get to the playoffs and everyone's so honed in on the main guys and what they can do. And the defense is locked into that, and it's the same team, game after game after game. And so you get into late in the series, and it always seems to be someone else that kind of tips the scales, a role player that is able to get a nice little run in one of the quarters or in one of the halves. And that's what Kaminsky did for them. It takes guys time, and being a rookie, he's got great height. He's mobile. He's mobile enough, I think, to handle most of the fours that Miami will throw out there. And so if you can get away with it, I mean, that's the question, right? That's the kind of the advantage, disadvantage when one team decides to go small, that you have to ask yourself, are we going to stay big and we're going to be weak kind of here and here, or are we going to try and match that? And it's happening in series all over, this playoffs. I mean, frankly, it's been happening all over the league the last couple of years. Those are the decisions you have to make, whether you're going to stay big and try and attack the small, or you're going to, go small and figure it out. And I think Charlotte found a little something there for them that if they can, get away with staying big with Kaminsky, who's more mobile defensively than Jefferson, then, it's something maybe they can exploit offensively.
Yeah, what was your initial reaction when you saw that Kaminsky was starting? I'll be honest, I thought it was lunacy. And then Spo went immediately right at it. The first play of the game, ran Luol Deng along the baseline for a screen, got a wide open three. And I think Deng was like 4 of 4 on threes in the first quarter. But when you first saw it, did you think that was a good move, or did its success surprise you?
I think I just kind of raised my eyebrows. I always like to see how things play out. I'm not much of like, I can't believe they're doing this, or I can't, I just say, okay, let's see how this works, and let's see what happens.
That's my job to say, I can't believe they're doing this.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of like to see how things play out, and, one quarter or one stretch, I mean, while that can kind of decide a game, I think you just need more of a sample size, and you need to say like, okay, let's see what's going to happen as the game goes on. Let's see what happens as guys get tired. Let's see what happens is if Frank kind of gets into this game and gets a chance to play and gets a chance to get a little bit of a rhythm. There's so many factors within a game that I just was like, okay, that's interesting. Let's wait and see how this works and how each team, deals with it.
Yeah, and Clifford, he had kind of that long statement to the press after game two about how, hey, we're going to just stick with what we're doing. We're not going to panic. We're not going to make a ton of adjustments. And defensively, I thought they did that. You know, they didn't overreact to the Heat hitting a ton of shots in the first couple of games. And it seemed like with Kaminsky, they even doubled down, helping into the paint even more and just dared Miami to make shots, and they couldn't in that game.
Yeah, I mean, from a numbers perspective, their defense was pretty good in the sense that they were forcing Miami to take tough shots in those first two games. Miami was just making them. I mean, there wasn't really much. You know, I thought they were doing a good job of, in terms of, you know, the degree of difficulty that they were forcing Miami into the first two games. It was just Miami was just making an unreasonable amount of those shots. So you had to figure that it would come down, that there would be some regression to the mean. And, you know, it was... I agreed, you know, with what Steve said after the game, because, you know, there are things that you just have to stick to. You can't change too much because of what, repetition wise, what you've practiced, who you are as a team. But there are adjustments, that you're making every game, and there are things that you're changing. It's just, you know, they might not be wholesale overall scheme changes, but there's no question from game to game, you're tweaking things, and, you know, you might be changing a call, or you might be, adding a set or adding a wrinkle. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you're doing in between games, but, yeah, I mean, the Hornets were a good defensive team this year. I didn't see them making changes, nor did I think they needed to after those first two games.
Yeah, and I thought the biggest thing that was just killing them too is, you know, Whiteside was going 9 of 9 from the field every game too, you know, and they took that away in game three, which I thought was pretty important. On Pacers Raptors, I really wanted to talk to you about this because, having played, I think you have a more nuanced perspective on this perhaps than I do. DeMar DeRozan has been able to get absolutely nothing going against Paul George. Like he, I mean, it looks like it's almost hopeless to me in some ways when he's matched up against him. You know, George can just go under on the pick and roll. When DeMar tries to ISO, George is quicker than him. He's got more length. He's just forcing him into tough shots, you know, contested twos every time. Is there anything that you think that they can do, first of all, to free him in these games coming up so he can have a little bit better of a performance?
It's hard to do. You know, Paul is so good defensively, and, you know, you hit on a couple really key points as far as this matchup, as far as this specific individual matchup. Because whenever you're looking at the individual matchup, you have to start with the individual skill sets of each guy, as an offensive player and as a defensive player. And, you know, we know DeMar doesn't shoot the three very well. So that changes what you're going to do if you're a defender on him, or I should say what you're allowed to do, what you can get away with, right? You're always wondering as a defender, like, hey, what can I get away with here with a guy that I'm guarding? What can I get away with? And you can get away with going under on DeMar because he's not a great outside shooter. He doesn't have tremendous range. And so Paul's able to do that. So that allows him to, you know, keep the integrity of his individual defense. He doesn't have to get in a chase situation, you know, chasing where you have to go over. You know, easiest example is Steph, where you have to go over on stuff with him, which automatically puts you chasing after him. Even in situations where it screens off the ball, you can go under, you can slide through, you can avoid kind of, you know, zigzagging through bodies and getting hit and getting tagged. You can just go under and avoid all of that. So, it's not even as physical, of a situation for him trying to navigate through screens because he can just slide under. He has terrific length, terrific athleticism. So it is very hard for DeMar to shake loose. I don't know how you change that because the problem with this is at the individual level. It's at the individual matchup level. There are ways, I think, or are some things that you can look to. Certainly anytime he's not on him, is a positive. And whether that's in transition and they get, you know, cross match for some reason, they get screwed up. I would look to attack anytime that Paul is not on him, because of whatever happened during the game. The other thing is, what I would try to do is I would try to look for opportunities, you know, set stuff like end out of bounds, side out of bounds, to try and get DeMar going right. That's the other piece to this, I think, that's really been illuminated is, you know, DeMar's left hand has to be much more evolved moving forward. I mean, he's got to really work on that because, you know, he has every player has an element of predictability to what they do offensively. And DeMar, to me, you know, he's so right-handed that some of the things that you would try and do and some of the spaces you would try to get into, it doesn't seem like he's as comfortable going left and being able to do that. So that creates, you know, less opportunity, less of the court for him to be able to explore. But I would try to look. I would try and look for those situations, you know, where he's not guarding him. The other thing, the other area that you can maybe try and force Paul to get into a chase situation is elbow splits instead of DHOs. So, like, if he can hitting the post at the elbow and getting a guard to come and screen for him, preferably left corner, so that DeMar's coming, you know, over it to his right hand. And where sometimes elbow splits works a little bit better than DHO is that you can control the location of it and you can get it closer in. So if guys are going under, one of the things you're trying to do is force them to go under closer to the basket, right? So sometimes you'll move the screen sure. down if you're doing it and try to force them to go over because it's just too close. But with elbow splits, you can effectively have that same effect if they're catching it as close to the elbow as possible and getting a screen and allowing him to get a handoff right there at the elbow. Now, if he goes under, it's a much more manageable shot for DeMar, or he might choose to go over, and then that allows DeMar to get into the lane. Also think the Pacers' bigs have been pretty good. I mean, even like icing pick and rolls and, you know, Miles Turner's been good. You know, Jan's been good. I mean, you see DeMar making a concerted effort to attack the big in ball screen situations because he doesn't want to attack Paul. But those guys have held up pretty strong as well. Ultimately, it just comes down to in the playoffs, DeMar's going to have to make some plays, and he's going to have to do it being guarded, and he's going to have to do it being guarded with length. And I don't know, besides some of those little things, that there's much more you can do because the flaw in this is the individual matchup. It's just not a good one for DeMar.
Yeah, the two things that occurred to me were, number one, just play him when George is out of the game. You know, change up your rotation for that, and then maybe also set some screens with Monte's man on him and try and get the switch. The Pacers, they've done that a little bit with Lowry, but George Hill is too good in pick and roll defense. They've been able to avoid switching, but I think if they went at Monte, then he's a little bit weaker, and maybe you would be able to fix it so he could get downhill on those plays. But I agree. I mean, I think he just doesn't have that much of a chance. My next question was, all right, you have a guy like this, one of the main guys on your team. He clearly has been totally ineffective. You know, I think he's taken 49 contested shots in the series and he's made 11 of them. You know, it's just not working. At some point, are you saying, all right, we're just not going to go to this guy as much? Or is that just not realistic when he's one of the guys who, you know, has been one of the drivers of the team's offense all year?
Yeah, I think that's hard to do. I think that's probably sending the wrong maybe corporate message of, hey, we're not good enough in our current in our state to beat this team. If you're gonna, you know, make a big change like that, and you got to have him on the floor because, I mean, at its basic level, even if DeMar is horrible, he's still forcing Paul to guard him, and Paul's not guarding someone else. You know what I mean? Like, even just with DeMar on the floor, like, at least Paul is being engaged and taken out and not wreaking havoc in other places. It's a hard thing. I think you just want to make sure that continue to make sure that DeMar has confidence, is playing with confidence, that he's taking you know, the shots that you want him to take. And at some point he's gonna break out. I think he'll have you know, a good stretch or a good game, but you just got to be really careful because mentally he's thinking about it. You know, he's thinking about it. You know, he's watching, you know he's watching tape. You know, he's very mindful of it. So from a psyche standpoint, I think you just have to maintain confidence. You know, maybe you show him clips of times that he's done a good job against guys with length through the course of the season, or, hey, you know, when we played this team, this worked, or maybe even against Paul during the regular season. I don't know. I didn't, you know, look at clips of him, you know, those two guys in the regular season. I've just, you know, really honed in on here in the playoffs. But I think you're always trying to worry about the mental state of your players, particularly your big guns. And so I just think it's really important that they continue to be positive with DeMar. And I'm not trying to sound like DeMar shaky mentally or anything like that, but it's just really important that guys are in the right frame of mind this type of year and continue to play with confidence. And I think that's what you do. I don't know that you make a huge deal out of it other than, those things that we talked about, trying to find ways as a coach to get him clean looks and, to get him a couple buckets and get him feeling good. And there are ways you can isolate that, after timeouts and, like I said, in transition. And if I'm Kyle, I'm really mindful of, trying to find him in advantageous situations. And you see, I mean, anytime they get a guy like Monte on him, they go right to DeMar. I mean, they seek that out. I mean, because they know that that's an advantageous situation for him and maybe that can get him going.
Yeah, when you know, in your playing career, did you ever have a time when someone on your team, you just would be open and just wasn't hitting shots or just didn't have a favorable matchup and you just kind of decided, all right, I'm maybe not going to pass it to this person as much? Or were you able to kind of, I'm not saying there's a right or wrong answer there, or, did you ever do something like that?
No,
without
not that
specifics,
I can.
Obviously.
No, not that I can think of. I mean, I think you're always aware of the skill sets of the people that you're playing with. So, yeah, like if I was coming off a screen and somebody was wide open and they weren't a great 3-point shooter and they're behind the line, yeah, I mean, you're always calculating that stuff in your head as far as, like, where can I put people in positions that they can be successful? If someone that typically is making shots or typically, if they're underproducing from what their norm is, you're trying to find ways to help them be successful. But as far as like not passing them the ball or I think you just continue to try and put them in good positions. When I'm playing, I'm more concerned with I don't have to do the substitutions. You know what I mean? So my thought is give everybody great looks in the areas that they normally score from. And if the coach doesn't want them to shoot, then they'll take them out. You know, I mean, you play with, that's their job. It's not my job to decide who shoots and who doesn't shoot. It's my job to put them in the best possible situation to be successful. So I always looked at it like that. And if the coach was tired of what they were doing, then they would take them out and put somebody else in.
I want to take a quick break from my conversation with Kara to tell you about Betterment. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace. Easy to remember that URL because we talk about cap space all the time on the program. That's the code or URL that we use for all of our sponsors. Betterment is the largest independent automating investing service out there. You've probably been hearing a lot about them in TechCrunch or the Wall Street Journal. Betterment makes it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest. It's built on smarter, cutting-edge technology that brings you sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services. More than 150,000 customers choose Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their dollars. And this is the perfect time to get started with Betterment and saving for your retirement or other financial goals because Dunked On listeners can get 6 months of no fees. Learn how at betterment.com/capspace, betterment.com/capspace, investing made better. So you've been watching all these series, obviously, preparing for the show. Are there any things that you've really liked as far as adjustments, specific plays, substitutions from some of the coaches in these playoffs?
Yeah, there's been, I can think of some in like all the series probably that have been good. I mean, the intriguing thing to me has been Kevin Love at the five because we didn't see a lot of it during the year. And then now I feel like every time I'm watching the game, there's a ton of minutes. I don't know the minutes. I haven't, emailed our stats people to get like the exact minutes, but it just seems like it's an insanely high number relative to the regular season with Cleveland, going small, so to speak. And so that's been kind of fun to watch and interesting to see. Certainly.
Do you like that alignment for them when the competition gets a little bit harder?
Well, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, I don't know. That's what's intriguing about the lineup is I don't know how it's going to play out because we haven't seen it against the top teams. So I'm very interested. I'm intrigued to see how it works and you know, what advantage, disadvantages, and how it all plays out. So I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be good enough for a finals matchup. If you're saying elite teams, I mean, Cleveland really is the only elite team in the East, and you know, there are a few in the West. So yeah, I don't know how that would work in a finals matchup, but I like the process, and I like the fact that they're, I don't know if it's trying it out or getting a lot of reps with it, you know, in these earlier series, to be able to have a good feel and a good rhythm with it. Should they advance to the finals and have a chance to use it against a top team. You know, I thought, you know, Boston and, you know, what Brad has been doing with his lineups, and it's been more, you know, out of necessity than it's been, you know, intentional, just not having, Avery and Kelly. You know, it's forced them to have to figure some different things out. I mean, Marcus was really good. Marcus Smart was really good on Paul, late yesterday. And, you know, it's kind of fun. Sometimes you fall into certain things that, you wouldn't fall into before, or maybe they're not falling into things. It's things that they know, but you know, it's manifesting itself a little bit more in the playoffs because of guys being out. You know, we referenced one earlier, Frank Kaminsky and you know, his ability and him being in the lineup and them featuring him a little bit, there in the third quarter when they went on their decisive run. So yeah, I mean, I think you could go on and on with different adjustments and different things, but certainly, the Kevin Love one is the one that I think has, you know, more big picture ramifications, just because, they're a team that's going to be contending and the other teams, you know, save Steph's injury. You know, San Antonio, it's been pretty much status quo for them. Golden State, it's been pretty much status quo for them. Same with Oklahoma City in terms of their rotation. So there's not been much as far as tinkering goes with those top teams.
Yeah, I would feel a little bit better about Love at center if they had one more good wing, you know, who was a two-way guy. You know, I think like Richard Jefferson is a little bit, you know, past his prime as far as, you know, really being a guy who's going to play in crunch time. And then Shumpert has struggled with injuries all year, and neither he nor Smith really quite has the size you would ideally like on the wing. So I worry about it defensively, but I think maybe they'll just be able to outscore people anyway.
Yeah, that kind of that fifth guy in that lineup is going to be a challenge, or I should say the fourth and fifth guy, depending on who's playing well. Yeah, I think they could cobble together enough minutes. I mean, they have Dellavedova's played well and he can play well with Kyrie, and he's big enough and strong enough, you know, to handle the two guards. But you're right, it becomes that three spot. And are you small with JR, Shumpert, who hasn't played well, or Richard Jefferson? So yeah, that becomes the issue for them, and that's the issue for everybody though, outside of the Warriors, isn't it? Is that when we go small, do we have guys that are good enough? Do we have enough guys that are good enough? And that's why you know, that's what makes them unique, and that's what makes the Warriors special, is that they go small and they have enough guys. Those are their best guys. You know, their best guys are their five when they go to a small lineup.
Were there any moves that you saw that maybe you didn't agree with as much that we've seen?
Oh, didn't agree with. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are. I think if something jumps into my head. I mean, there's. I think that, you know, I think the Oklahoma City thing, everybody talks about it, and obviously in game two down the stretch, you know, what they run and how they get to it and all of those things. So would you like to see, you know, things go a little bit differently for them as they execute down the stretch? Yeah, I would. But I also understand that that's kind of what they are. That's kind of who they are. And, you know, I don't know that that's going to change. And certainly we haven't seen it change too much this season, you know, a lot to their detriment, particularly in fourth quarters. But that remains a thing that I think when you look at them through the prism of being a championship team, that's still always, you know, your number one question mark. But I also, you know, you look at yesterday, you look at Jeff Teague and down the stretch and what, you know, them having a chance to win and not even getting a shot off, right? at the end of at the end of regulation. Sometimes you draw stuff up and it just doesn't, from a rhythm standpoint, go the way you anticipate, and it ends up looking really, really bad. And I think that was one of those, you know, one of those situations. I think that you know, there's as much as there's been things that I've liked, there's been some things that I disagree with. But in disagreeing, I think I'm always mindful of knowing that I don't know the entire story. Like, that's the thing, I think, as a player, you know, having played, where you understand when something goes wrong, like when I'm watching a game and something goes wrong, I'm mindful that sometimes I'm not going to be able to pinpoint why it went wrong and whose fault it was, because people screw up and you can't always tell who it is that screwed up. If you're looking at it from just an overall scheme perspective, yeah, I mean, the coaches are putting that in, they're putting the game plan together, but sometimes it's very difficult to know if it's a player, you know, messed up the play or made the wrong read. Sometimes you're not really sure what's going on. So that sometimes is hard. I shouldn't say hard. Sometimes I'm slow to criticize, you know, in the moment when I'm watching, just because I'm not always sure kind of what went wrong. I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm not always sure whose fault it is and why something went wrong in the game.
And I'm probably can be a little guilty, especially as kind of more of an outsider, of maybe doing that too quickly, although I've definitely had times where I've talked to people afterwards and they've corrected me when I've been wrong about that kind of stuff. Another thing I wanted to ask you about is kind of rest and substitution patterns. And, you know, typically players will play more minutes in the playoffs. Some coaches are more comfortable really extending their guys. You know, LeBron will play 42, 43 minutes. We saw James Harden played like basically the first like 36 minutes of the game or something in game four against Golden State. I mean, when you have sort of just an in his prime player, what do you think is the most minutes that it's realistic for them to play in this kind of a high pressure environment?
You know, I think the most probably is around that 42, 43 minutes. You know, you can play a lot. I mean, these guys are machines. They're so fit. You know, they've played all year. You know, you can play your guys most of the game at this point. You factor in, you know, the playoffs, and I mean, some of these series, what are they, like every 4 days, or they get three days in between the games. You know, the worst is the first day after the game in terms of soreness and just fatigue. You know, you start to feel a little bit better. And, if you have to play every other, you know, it's a little bit more challenging physically, but, when you get some of these pockets, you know, where every series has, you know, a couple, it feels like every series has at least three day windows. You can go in the 40s and so much in the playoffs, it comes down to how many two way guys do you have? You know, like you were talking about that with Cleveland, like how many guys do you have that aren't liabilities on one end? So, I'm certainly not going to limit my guys that have no liabilities on either end, or I shouldn't say that aren't a liability on either end, because I'm more than likely putting in a player that does have a liability on offense or defense, by taking that player out. So, I would totally be playing, my two way guys, as much as possible, because that's going to limit, where I can be exploited on either end. And, the more two way guys that you have out on the floor, the less energy that you have to expend as a player. So, you know, if you have all five players on the floor, offensively that are capable, then that means that, you know, the pressure and the attention to all of them is, while it's never going to be all the way equal, because some are better than others, say on offense, it's going to be as equal as it can get. Where basketball gets challenging is when you're playing with people that have liabilities on one end or the other, because now on the offensive end, they're not guarding a guy. So now it's 5-on-4 or 4-on-5 in a lot of situations. Defensively, now you're mindful. I mean, you're mindful if you're a post player, and one of the guys that you're playing with on the perimeter is challenged defensively. You know that you probably got to help a little bit quicker. You got to help a little bit sooner. Your defense is going to be put in rotation. I mean, there's all these things that happen. So if I'm a player, I want the two-way guys out there as much as possible, because it just makes for a lighter load that you're carrying through, you know, through the course of the game.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about is someone who's played a lot at a high level, is one of my little pet theories is that the way that players are rested in the NBA doesn't make that much sense, right? Like most players, you know, you play the first quarter if you're a good player, and you sit out 6 minutes at the start of the second quarter, and then you come back in and you play the final 6 minutes. And to me, that seems like you're kind of wasting some of the time on the bench in a way, because, you know, it doesn't take you 6 minutes, which is probably like, you know, 15 minutes in actual time to recover. And I always felt like it would be better if you just rested guys in two shorter stints per half. We've seen some teams like the Hawks and Spurs do that a little more, the Mavs with Dirk as well. What's your theory on that? And, you know, is it just that you can't, if you're subbing out more often, you can't get into a rhythm? And, you know, do you think that kind of recovery concept, you know, are you recovered within, you know, 5 minutes and you can go back in, or is it helpful to actually sit on the bench for 15 straight minutes?
Well, when you're talking to a player, you never like coming out. So if you ask me, like, well you know, what's your preferred substitution? I say never. You know, like, I don't want to come out again. What are you talking about? Like, so I never really liked, you know, the hard and fast rules of, you know, okay, at 6 minutes you're coming out, or at 3 minutes you're coming out. Like, what if I got it going? You know, what if I'm playing well, or what if I'm feeling good? And the games are different games too. So there's some games where you're more tired than others, just based on how the game is going, if it's up and down, how physical it is. I mean, there's different kind of ways that you can, if there's a lot of stoppages, shooting a ton of free throws where you're able kind of to gather yourself. So I think it just depends with your best players. I mean, we're really talking the star players. I mean, you know, for the most part, right? Because your rotation guys, your you know, players that are coming off the bench or that are not playing those high level minutes, you're not really worried about their win because they're not playing enough minutes for it to matter, right? I mean, if you're playing 20 minutes a night, you're not as worried about a guy. You're not as worried about that guy. I think it's just a conversation, you know, that I think the players have and the coaches have with each other, saying like, how do you feel? Like, how good do you feel? And, you know, some of that is, you're hopefully not having those conversations like at this time, right? You've hopefully had those conversations, but I'm sure it's something that they talk with the players about, that they talk with Dirk about, that they talk with, you know, LeBron about, and say, you know, how do you feel? You know, how do you feel? And how many minutes, you know, are you comfortable playing? And, you know, I just don't see, like, why should LeBron ever come out, you know, once a half for a couple minutes?
Yeah,
I think
in the playoffs, you're saying,
yeah,
right?
In the playoffs,
in the regular season,
for sure. In the regular season, it's different. But I still think that's a conversation with the guys in terms of their body and how they feel and, you know, what's nagging with them and all of that. So, it's definitely a conversation in the regular season, particularly with older players, you know, with players in their 30s. But yeah, I never liked, obviously, yeah, you never like coming out. And then the other thing that I never liked sitting, I don't really like sitting down. Like, I think the bench is terrible to, like, if you just think of it from like a biomechanics standpoint, like, you're sitting down.
I totally
on the bench.
Agree with you.
Those
on
guys
that.
Are
yeah.
so big. Like, they're so big. It's uncomfortable for me. I'm 5'8". So,
yeah,
you know,
you've got like your knee at like, you know, this like acute, like, you know, 60 degree angle. Like, you can't like extend your legs or anything. You're like leaning forward. Like, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's bad. And then not only that, it's not like you're watching action that's directly in front of you. You know, the action, it only half the time is the action directly in front of you. What are you doing the rest of the time? You're straining towards your right or towards your left. So you're sitting in this position, and then you're turning your body and your neck to watch play that's going on like diagonal from you. I just don't understand how that constitutes like the best way to be, you know, sitting or resting or, you know, staying warm. Between a game, it just seems to me just to be the worst possible scenario. And then there's not even place for you to like warm up, you know, like how the soccer players warm up before, you know, if you're someone that sat for a long time, there's not like an area for you to go and warm up. So yeah, I always just like to lay at the end of the bench, you know, their floor. Sometimes there's area there, it's crowded, but just to have your body be like flat, like Steve Nash used to do, remember, kind of like at the end of the bench.
Oh yeah.
Because then you're facing, you know, you're facing all the action, and you're able to like lay down, as opposed to having that, you know, having that 90 degree angle with your knees. It's that to me I found better, but you know, I don't know that we're gonna revolutionize benches here.
I don't know, like I've always wondered that too, and especially as far as like warming up as well. You'll see these times where end of the quarter they send in like this 33-year-old guy for one defensive possession who hasn't played the entire game. I'm like, how are you supposed to be warm and play well on that when you're just called off the bench? There's some guys like Derrick Rose, Dennis Rodman used to do it when he would come off the bench, where they would hit the exercise bike. I think that helps a little bit. Even something like, getting 2-3 shots up, if there was like a practice court, hidden in the bowels of the arena that you could go to before you're supposed to go in, especially if you're like a kind of designated shooter type where, it takes you a little bit to maybe feel like you're perfectly locked in, that would be another thing too. It's really, it's kind of surprising me. And you'll see the only guy I'll ever see who would warm up beforehand is like Manu Ginobili. If he was coming in and there was like after a timeout, he would just go out in the court and like run a couple, jog through a couple of sprints and do some slides. But other than that, yeah, everyone just seems like they're coming in cold, and that doesn't seem very optimal to me.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've never liked it. As always, you feel way more stiff than need be if you're coming out and have to go back in. So, that's another reason why to just keep them in. that's another reason why you just keep all the star players in.
So you are one of the commentators, at least among those who actually played, I found, who seems to have more interest in analytics than a lot like it. So you tweeted the other day about how someone in your pickup game had 70% usage, which made me chuckle. I played in a similar pickup game on Saturday night. But for your own game, what are some of the statistics that you're most interested in about yourself to kind of evaluate how you're playing, where you might need to improve, what's going well?
Oh, wow. This is analytics is kind of, few and far between on the women's side. Sue Bird wrote a good piece for, I think it was Players Tribune. I don't remember. But about kind of the lack of analytics in the WNBA. And so it's not something that it's hard to find as far as for when I'm playing. So I've found more experience with it and kind of gotten to know about it more covering the game as a broadcaster than I ever kind of used it for playing, because the data is not really there. It's not been out there. Save individual teams, like WNBA teams employing their own, analytics people to have those numbers. And that's dependent on the team, that I've been with, of whether there's been people that did that, and making that available to the players that play, like not just the coaches using it for their own tool, sure, but and also making it available. So if I've been a part of teams that had those positions, I just kind of, I don't know if they find me annoying, but I just talk to those people all the time.
Are you kidding? No, you know they love it. Like,
yeah,
that's why the people are in it, right? So they want to be a part of sports to interact. I'm sure that they're eating that up.
Yeah, so I talk to our guys, and just if we would be warming up or whatever, asking them questions or asking them to explain to me what this means. What does this stat mean, or why do you have it, or how do you evaluate? Because I'm still very much in the learning stage of it, just trying to learn what stats are, what those mean, and why they think it's effective. And then I would be talk to them, well, what about this or what about that? And so I just ask questions a lot. I like to learn. There's a ton out there on the NBA side, which is cool. And I'll just message people if I don't understand something. I DM a little bit with Seth Partnow at Nylon Calculus, and if I have a random question, I just DM him and say, hey, what is this? Can you explain this to me, or what does this mean, or what about this? And everybody seems really has been really receptive to my questions. And we just got Second Spectrum, if am I saying that right, or is that the so we just got that at ESPN. So I just had my first, it wasn't like a tutorial, but just Ben Alomar, who's our director of analytics at ESPN, just kind of introduced some of that stuff to me just a few days ago. So now I'm like super intrigued about it and want to learn. So it's just, for me, it's just a great tool. I mean, I just find it to be a great tool. I don't know why someone wouldn't think it was a great tool. And I like to see if it matches up with what my eyes are seeing. And most of the time it does match up with what my eyes are seeing. But there are times where it doesn't. And so then I'm fascinated to see why. you know, like, why is there a difference in what I thought I was seeing and kind of what the numbers are saying? And, you know, I think it's just a quest to understand the game more. Those of us that are around the game, I mean, you love the game, you want to, your whole goal, you know, as a player, your whole goal is to master the game, right? I mean, that's why you play. You're trying to improve and you're trying to get better at it in any way that you can. And you're very aware, or you should be self-aware of, you know, what are your weaknesses? You know, how can you improve on them? And that's kind of the approach I take to, you know, to broadcasting is, all right, I want to know as much as there is to know about the game. Okay, what areas do I really need to learn more? Do I really need to hone in on? And, you know, I kind of identified analytics as one of them that I needed to learn more about, just because, well, my experience as a player in the WNBA, we didn't have a ton of it. So I'm probably a little bit more behind than, say, the average NBA player, because it's being used in a lot of organizations and the guys are aware of, you know, I think they are. Some of them are aware of the different stats and all that. So, yeah, I'm just more in a quest for learning, and, you know, it's fun. It's kind of fun to see how much you can, you know, you can look at. Like, one of the stats they sent us was the quality of shots that the people you pass to get. And, you know, that was interesting to see, you know, like Kyle Lowry is number one in the playoffs, at least, you know, a couple of days ago he was. I don't know the computation from the last couple of days, but he's number one in terms of, you know, the value of the shots he creates for his teammates, like the quality of shots he creates for his teammates.
That makes sense. He had like that period in game two where he was like spent the entire first half setting up Jonas Valanciunas layups on pick and rolls. That makes perfect sense.
Right. So it makes sense. So then a lot of people, you know, like surface wise would say like, oh man, Kyle Lowry's really struggling in this series. Like he needs to get better. He needs to do this. He needs to do that. And that may be so from like a field goal percentage standpoint. But from the standpoint of part of his job, a big part of his job description as a point guard is creating, you know, quality shots for his teammates. And he's doing that. And he's doing that at a rate better than anyone else in the playoffs right now. So are we really saying that he's struggling as a whole, or is he just struggling being efficient on the offensive end, you know, shooting wise? And so, you know, those are things that, you know, you look at, you know, where those stats, you know, can provide, you know, value for you. And even the same thing, like Russell Westbrook's number two in that stat. Okay. And, you know, he's been really good passing the ball here in these playoffs, similar thing. I mean, getting Steven Adams, getting Cantor, just quality looks at the basket. And so that type of stuff is really interesting to me, kind of those type of stats that allow you to, you know, just give people kind of, you allow you to quantify something, you know, allow you to quantify the impact. And that's a big part of basketball. That to me is what makes analytics so cool, is like, gosh, we have the ability to quantify so many things in the sport of basketball that for a long time, like, I didn't know that you could quantify this, you know, defense or, you know, whatever it is. It's just, to me, it's really, really interesting. I'd like to learn more. I'm a baby analytic person, just a baby.
All right. Well, so I know you have to go. So last question, I'll close on something that you and I agree on. So that's why I selected it. At the close of one of your shows last week, you mentioned that you probably would have gone with Andre Iguodala over Jamal Crawford as the sixth man of the year. You guys were closing out, so you didn't really get a chance to elaborate on it. So what was your thinking on that?
I mean, I just watched them. I just watched the Warriors play, and Iguodala to me is, I mean, if I could pick one player, you know, to have off the bench, I would pick him. He's versatile. He's a very good defender. He's efficient offensively. He just can do it all, and he's doing it for a team, you know, that had the best regular season record. And I don't know, to me it was just, but I also would have picked Steph for most improved as well. I mean,
me too.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean,
because he's doing stuff that, like, no one in NBA history has ever done before. I mean, like, when you just, because I think with you having played, you might think about improvement in the same way, as just what skills have you added? Like, how have you added to your skill level? And he's added to his skill level to the point that he's taking shots that, like, no one else in NBA history has ever taken, like, much less made.
Yeah, it's kind of the always the question that you have to ask yourself for that award, right? Is it a guy that's better because it's a function of his, you know, increased minutes? Or is it a guy that's better because it's a function of, you know, his improved skill? And sometimes it's both. Sometimes a guy gets more minutes and he's improved his skill some. But, yeah, what Steph is there, like, it's way harder to go from, you know, 23 points to 30 points than it is to go from, you know, 10 to 20 or, you know, 5 to 17. Because more often than not, the 5 to 17 is accompanied by, you know, minutes. And you look at the efficiency of Steph this year. Like, it just, you run out of superlatives because what he did in the regular season this year, like, it just doesn't happen. It is crazy. It is crazy.
It's so
how
ridiculous.
Well, it is so crazy. Like, it just doesn't.
Like, I'm just laughing 5 times a game at some of the stuff that he's been doing.
Yeah, it's, I hope he's okay. I hope he gets back. You know, I hope, you know, he's all right. And, you know, we get a chance to, you know, we get a chance to see them, you know, in their full glory here in the playoffs, the Warriors. But, yeah, what he did this year was just special. I mean, it was just special. And, you know, I think he deserved most improved. Most improved. I think he deserved most improved. And, I would have taken, you know, Iguodala for sixth man. But I love Livingston too. He might have been my number 2 pick. So.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate your taking the time. I know how busy you've been. Do you know what game you'll be broadcasting at this weekend?
No, not yet. We're waiting on the end of these series. So we might not know until, you know, Thursday night, depending on if some of these, I think it might depend on if these go 7 or not. You know, like, who goes 7? So is it game 7 of a series this weekend, or is it game 1 of the Eastern Conference or Western Conference semifinals?
Yeah.
So, no, I probably won't know till, my guess is maybe even Thursday or Friday, depending on if these series, a lot of these 2-2s get closed out in 6, or if they, you know, they go to a decisive 7th game. But either way, I think it's going to either be a game 7 or a game 1. So that'll be great either way.
Yeah, well, we're looking forward to seeing you do that broadcast. You follow Kara on Twitter, KaraLawson20, is that right?
Yeah, you got it.
And also, if you want to find out a little bit more about her career, she did an interesting podcast with SI's Richard Deitch about a month ago that you might want to listen to as well. If you want to find kind of more a little about her broadcasting background. So thanks so much for coming on, Kara, and we will talk to you all next time. All right, Danny and I are actually going to talk a little bit about the news on the Steph Curry injury. But first, our friends at Vistaprint would like me to let you know about their offer for 500 business cards for just $9.99 when you enter my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. Remember that code? That's the one we use for all of our sponsors. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the show. And also important because then they know that you came from us and they will continue to advertise on the show and support it. Vistaprint is great for small business owners. They offer tons of custom products for home and office needs, whether it's postcards, flyers, banners, apparel, invitations, and as a small business owner, I've used their services and they do a great job. You can customize the text, colors, backsides of your business cards if you want. If you want to upgrade to a thicker stock or add a brilliant finish or something like that, you can do it. And all of that is very easy to use and very user-friendly online. It's basically your local print shop, but it's online and it's cheaper because they have great economies of scale. So remember that 500 business cards starting at just $9.99 using that code CAPSPACE at checkout. This is an exciting offer for a great product, so don't wait. Go to Vistaprint.com and order today using that CAPSPACE code. All right, I wanted to record a brief addendum to the podcast with Kara because when she and I were talking, the Steph Curry news came out. Danny is going to join me to talk about that. It is a grade 1 MCL strain for Steph, and he is going to be reevaluated in 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think this is realistically the best case scenario for the Warriors. There were, you know, of course, dream situations that it would have been shorter, but I think this is about as good as they could have hoped for.
I agree with you about kind of what we thought. I think the most important thing is, number one, this is not something that's going to be career altering. You know, it's not the type of thing where it's grade 2 where he would have to come back with a brace. It's still big trouble for sure, you know, and depending on who ends up winning that Clippers-Portland series, you have to imagine it'll probably be the Clippers, how well the Clippers are playing. I mean, that would make you think that the earliest time frame would be basically, you know, game 3, game 4 of that series, depending on when it starts. You know, obviously if the first round series goes longer, it won't start as early. And then, you know, you're talking about him having to get his rhythm again when he comes back, his conditioning. You're talking about him just being reevaluated in 2 weeks. It doesn't mean he's necessarily going to come back, although Jeff Stotts said that that kind of two-week period is right about where the average return to play has been for these low-grade MCL strains. So there is some hope, but, you know, and Kevin Pelton thought that they still would have a decent chance maybe of beating the Clippers with the home court, with their regular team, but the path certainly got a lot harder.
Yeah, it got a lot harder, and the big question is, of course, going to be not only when he gets back, but what will he be? We talked on last night's podcast about the idea of him being a decoy for some of that stretch, and that's certainly a possibility. But the other important thing about this time frame is I do think it makes it more likely that he can be not 100%, but closer to it by the start of a Western Conference final, should they make it there. And while, of course, getting there will be an immense challenge, they need him at close to full strength to be there. And it being a lesser thing, I think makes that more possible. It's definitely not likely, but more possible.
Yeah, and there are a lot of things that they can do with him where he's not necessarily on the ball in the pick and roll. I mean, I think a lot of what we will see more of with him, if he's not quite himself, but still is like a great standstill shooter, is him screening, you know, 4-1 pick and roll type of stuff with Draymond Green, maybe even some stuff with Klay Thompson as well, where now you get the switch with Thompson, and Thompson will have the height advantage on the point guard, him back screening for guys for alley-oops. That's something that he can do, that as long as, you know, where you're really leveraging the threat of him even more than just relying on his actual scoring. And then also you wonder, too, defensively, if it's a Clippers series, he's going to have to either chase around J.J. Redick or he's going to have to guard Chris Paul. Neither of those is an easy assignment for a guy coming back from injury. And then also you wonder about the conditioning, because one of the things about Steph that makes him so incredible is he just never stops running. He never stops moving. And, you know, if he's going to have, he already has had some time on the shelf with this foot injury. And now you have to imagine, even if he starts trying to work back and rehab, you can't simulate any kind of game condition. So that's going to be another issue as well. He's just much more of a rhythm player, much more of a finely tuned machine than just, you know, I think some big guy who dunks a lot. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of reason for concern, even though this is, as you mentioned, the most positive, realistic outcome.
And I think that duality is important to understand and acknowledge, because the idea is that, yeah, this is the best possible news, but it's still not great news. I mean, the Warriors are going to have a tough track to do much in this playoffs, but that's when injuries happen, and as I said last night, this is a villainless thing. It's just a bad thing to happen. You still have to appreciate it for what it is.
Another thing that's huge is that they were able to win last night.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because you would be kind of wondering, if it were 2-2 right now, would they even be able to win this series against the Rockets? They probably would be favorites. But nonetheless, you know, and now you have all these other guys, Sean Livingston especially, you know, he's kind of been limited to 30 minutes a game by Kerr. Is now, are they going to extend that with him being out there for a long time, you know, or is it going to be more Ian Clark now? He's really the closest other thing to a backup point guard. Andre Iguodala is going to have to play a lot more minutes too. You have some of these older guys. So getting them some rest, if indeed they can close out the Rockets on Wednesday, will be really huge for the guys who are going to have to pick up the slack as well.
And that also means they're going to have a lot more stress on, they're going to have a lot more miles on if they make it farther, just that will already be built in. This was a Warriors team that had that structural advantage that, you know, they had a very winnable first round series, and they had a second round opponent that looked weaker than the two teams on the other side. And they're not going to have that advantage. However, I don't think that cumulative miles will make a big difference other than the possibility of another injury. And that's something you and I have talked about in the year plus that we've done Dunked On, is that any injury has its own impact, but also it leads to a cascading effect if anything else happens. And I think that's the other possibility to consider here.
Yeah, now what Kerr is going to do, is he still going to be going to Ian Clark? Can he play the way that he's played in these last two games, or is he going to revert to the way he was, shooting 21% on threes and since the All-Star break, and 38% overall, and turning the ball over like crazy? Is Leandro Barbosa, is he going to get more minutes now, be back in the rotation? Can he give them something? Those two guys, there's going to be a lot of pressure on them. Do they go a little bit more with Rush, have Iguodala play the backup point guard? Like, those three guys, Rush, Clark, and Barbosa, are going to have a lot of pressure on them now to really, and one of the reasons that the Warriors have been so good is that they didn't have any guys really, you know, other than the Varejao era, who were really exploitable. Spates is another guy who's going to have to play really, really well for them because they're just going to need more offense in general. Is he going to be able to keep it going the way he's played the last 2-3 months of the year? A lot of pressure on some guys who, you know, have performed okay at times in the regular season, but also, you know, this is the playoff crucible now where anybody, any weakness is going to get taken advantage of.
And it's also a test for Kerr in terms of his mentality for separating his best players, because they're, you know, the Warriors have done a solid job of minimizing the amount of time that Klay Thompson and Stephen Curry were off the court together. Actually, that was some of the most impactful minutes most Bates has played in recent time. Now, their two best players are Klay and Draymond Green, and so will they play them a little bit more together? Because if you separate them, you're creating some really tough lineups. And also, how willing are they to roll out the non-Curry death lineups? Because they actually do have some really amazing defensive potential with some of those units. Keshawn Livingston, you know, he's more balanced in height. I was used to reference that as like a West Virginia team where like everybody's around 6'7", and because they had one of those teams when I was in college. And if they go to that, that can be an interesting thing. It's not necessarily the greatest against theoretically the Clippers, but it is something that's worth considering. And so I think we're going to learn a lot about Steve Kerr, the coach and the tactician, during this time, whether or not it ends up being relevant for the championship.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the argument against some of the great coaches like Phil Jackson and Greg Popovich was, well, you had Tim Duncan, you had Shaq, you had Kobe, you had Jordan, you had Pippen, blah, blah. If Steve Kerr can successfully navigate them through this time period, his chops as a coach certainly will be burnished a little bit. All right, that'll do it for just this quick one here. Follow me on Twitter, Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. And also, don't forget our sponsors for this episode, Betterment and Vistaprint. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening.